One quick little thing. Mr. Kurt Decker interview, marker.
Great. Okay, today is Thursday, February 15th, 2018, and I'm here with Curtis Decker in his office in Washington, D.C. Mr. Decker, do you consent to this interview being taped and recorded?
I do.
Thank you. Would you please introduce yourself as you would introduce yourself to a stranger, your title, however you...
I'm Curtis Decker, and I'm currently the Executive Director of the National Disability Rights Network, also known as NDRN, and we are a membership association of legally based advocacy agencies around the country created by Congress to represent people with disabilities. And the membership association here in Washington monitors progress in Congress and the administration to assure that these programs continue and grow. And we also provide a lot of training and technical assistance to the member agencies around the country. There happens to be one in every state and territory, so it's a very comprehensive network.
I will ask you more about that toward the end of the interview, but let's go all the way back. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Albany, New York, back in the 40s, and spent most of my early life, all of my early life there, and then ended up going to college out in the western part of New York, Hamilton College, and then on to Cornell Law School.
And when did you come to Baltimore, and what brought you to Baltimore City?
Well, it was an interesting sort of set of events. When I graduated Cornell Law School in 1969, I literally needed another year of deferment to avoid participating in the Vietnam War. And at the time, there was a program called VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America, that were looking for attorneys to be assigned to various legal agencies around the country. And I joined, and they sent me to Baltimore, Maryland, which I had basically never heard of. I had actually taken the New York bar after graduating law school, thinking that I would clearly live in New York and most likely New York City and do a legal career there. That didn't happen. After a year as a VISTA volunteer at Baltimore Legal Aid Bureau, it was quite enlightening to me to see the issues that were coming into that agency, and I became very involved with representing low-income people on a variety of issues in the poverty arena, food stamps, health benefits, welfare benefits, and got very involved in helping organize welfare recipients to sort of speak for themselves in the Maryland legislature and other places, and got quite excited about those issues, which I had not, by the way, been trained at all at Cornell Law School. That was a very conservative, corporate-oriented law school, so this was a totally different view of the world than I had been trained for.
I'll jump ahead a little bit, but I want to come back to law school. Did you have to take the Maryland bar?
I did not. I was able to, when I needed to be in court in Maryland, there was an ability to be waived in for specific cases. So much of my work was administrative hearings and, as I said, organizing. It morphed into lobbying in Annapolis on legislation. And so when I did have a case to go to court, I could be what they would call waived in for that particular case.
So at what point in your life did you become interested in studying the law?
Well, again, frankly, it was sort of serendipitous. I went to Hamilton and was a history major, and I was pretty much, what do you do next? And looked at potentially going to school for history and decided that I'd apply to law school. So there wasn't any great burning desire to be a lawyer. I just sort of thought that was the next natural step.
To someone who doesn't know much about the legal profession, how would you describe the area of law that you've specialized in throughout your career?
Well, it's an area of the law that I thought was slow to evolve. As I said earlier, at Cornell, it was all very much about corporate law, trust and estates, tax, business. There were no courses in those days on sort of the social issues. I'm happy to say that that has changed dramatically over the last 30, 40 years, and many law schools will have clinics on poverty, on LGBT issues, on women's issues, so that I think lawyers today, law students today, are exposed to the areas of law that I now work in. So I really consider myself incredibly lucky that I had sort of sent off into a different direction than I had thought I would go into, and it kind of exposed me to these issues that I had some inkling that I liked. I had volunteered in the summer when I was in college to work with kids in poverty areas in Albany, but this work really resonated with me, and I felt really connected to it, which is why when at the end of my year in Vista, the Legal Aid Bureau offered me a job, I accepted, and I live in Baltimore part-time to this day.
I didn't plan to ask you this, but I won't forgive myself if I don't, because you mentioned the Vietnam War. Were you aware when you were at Cornell of Father Daniel Berrigan? Was he a presence on campus?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm in all honesty, it wasn't, as I said, it wasn't my joining Vista was not an altruistic effort. It was clearly done to avoid the draft, and because I didn't think that was a good place for me to be. And as I think there's a certain irony that it actually changed my life dramatically, and I am spending the rest of my career doing that kind of work by having had the Vista experience.
Were you the type of person who went to anti-war demonstrations? Or
initially, yes. I remember back in 1969-70, there was a lot of demonstrations about the war, and I was in Baltimore, so I came over to a couple of demonstrations on the Mall in those days.
I wanted to ask you, at what point in your life did you come out as a gay man?
Well, there's very points in one's life, I think, that that you deal with that issue. I happen to be one of those people who knew I was gay very early, but it was the 50s in upstate New York. There was nothing in the media or the press. I think it's interesting to see how people today are just totally exposed to the whole range of issues on LGBT, you know, in the media, wherever. So that was a struggle, very frightening, very scary, sort of realizing that you were different, not really knowing what that meant, and being very afraid of that being a very stigmatizing part of your life. And so you sort of hid that as much as you could. And sort of the things you do to, you know, ingratiate yourself with your peers is interesting. I ended up being the president of the senior class at Albany Senior High School, but it was the whole time very, very nervous, scared about that. I probably actually came out officially after I left, when I came to Baltimore. And for me, I connected that starting to work and realizing that I was a person of worth and not in that sort of very competitive environment of college and law school, realized that this was something I could identify with and be public about. And of course, as so many people who do that, when you finally do that, all your friends say, well, finally, thank God, we always knew. So that was that. And then I think the other point in one's coming out experience is how you deal with your family. Because I lived in Baltimore and my family lived in Albany, I didn't really talk to them until I was 36 years old. So, you know, how one deals with one's family, I think, is always an interesting issue for people in the LGBT community.
How did you find coming out in Baltimore? Was it difficult? Was there a welcoming community?
Well, I've been fortunate in my life in having a lot of friends of all types, and so it wasn't that difficult. As I said, it was almost people were, you know, claimed they knew, and they were glad that I finally admitted it. So it wasn't that dilemma. I didn't have friends who shunned me or dropped me. And again, I didn't deal with my family right away. So, I mean, that can always be a difficult time for some folks who find their families not very welcoming to that issue. So I didn't have that. Didn't have that experience.
Was Mount Vernon the first neighborhood that you lived in Baltimore?
No, not really. The VISTA required you to live with a family, and so I actually, for the first 7 weeks of my time in Baltimore, lived off of Pennsylvania Avenue on a little street called Woodger Street, and moved in with an African-American family. So the recent riots in Baltimore around the Freddie Gray example was right in the neighborhood that I had lived in. So that was sort of interesting, resonant for me. From there, we were given a house in West Baltimore that had been bought to torn down to extend the highway, and then the activists stopped the highway, and so there were these houses available, and the city gave that to the VISTA volunteers. And then I moved into Bolton Hill for about 3 years, and then eventually bought my house in Mount Vernon in 1974.
I wanted to ask you about, before I do that though, so you probably were in a neighborhood where you saw the after effects of the 68 uprising, or riots as they called them. I'm assuming this was years after, but you could probably still see the effects of that?
Yes, well, remember, when I moved in with the family in West Baltimore, that was 1969, a year after the riots, and Pennsylvania Avenue had been one of the affected neighborhoods. So I was very early in my coming to Baltimore, saw the results of the riots. And then even in 1974, many people told me that I was, really making a big mistake buying a house at Mount Vernon, because it was downtown and, the city was crumbling, and what was that going to do? And I sort of resisted that, attempt. The house happened to be one of those unique Baltimore townhouses that still survive, and I decided that I would take the chance, and so I went ahead and bought it, and I'm still there.
And how do you feel like Mount Vernon has changed since you were first there? My understanding is that it was kind of a hub for alternative lifestyle cultures. Hippies hung out on Reed Street.
Right, exactly.
I don't know when the Club Hippo opened.
I do.
I don't remember which year, but it was kind of the center of
yes.
LGBTQ life for Baltimore City.
Well, it's exactly. I mean, the city, the neighborhood itself, I think, has been relatively stable. Things open, things close. And it doesn't seem to get the oomph that the Inner Harbor has, but it also doesn't have that many serious problems. It was seen, and I think today still sort of has a reputation of being the gay neighborhood, which I don't really think so. I think many, many gays have moved out. There was an epidemic of my friends moving to the county and getting farms. Now the bars still exist, and so that sort of still gives the cachet that it's the gay neighborhood. But I mean, I learned a valuable lesson in getting involved in some local politics, in that people thought, you could run as a gay person and win. And it turns out, no, there are high rises for the elderly. The way the city is districted, it's connected to a lot of, African American neighborhoods. And so it just doesn't, if people think it's the gay neighborhood, I don't think that's the case anymore.
I wanted to ask you about discrimination against gays and lesbians back in the 70s and 80s. You left some materials at the Historical Society, and one in particular, the document in support of a gay rights bill for Baltimore City from 1988. There were some really horrible stories, case studies in that report. Things landlords did to people, state hospitals, the way they discriminated on job applications. Can you talk about how real discrimination felt at that point back in the you were there in the 70s and 80s?
Well, I think, you know, initially, I think there was always just sort of that undercurrent of fear about discrimination, accompanied with a whole, you know, lifestyle of clubs and bars, you know, that that people gravitate. So it was a very, you know, schizophrenic kind of existence of having the venues and places where you felt comfortable, but at the same time, sort of looking over your shoulder to whether your employer, you know, or your, you know, neighborhood or whatever, you know, at any time could turn on you. I was fortunate in working in legal aid in a very progressive area, so that really wasn't a concern of mine personally. But when we began to do that work, to try to document discrimination, to make the case to, in this case, the city council people, you know, trying to get people to come forward and talk about, you know, what they'd experienced, because you really do need those specific stories to, you know, to resonate with people who are very concerned about, you know, taking a stand that would actually, you know, possibly damage their careers. I mean, that's still the case today in Congress and other places where without those real stories, you don't make that much progress. And sometimes even with the stories, such as what just happened in terms of, you know, gun violence, you still can't get many policymakers to go, you know, to do the right thing for fear of losing their position.
So you sort of alluded to the Baltimore police being in the news a lot lately. Do you recall what the relationship, maybe in the Mount Vernon neighborhood or with the gay community at large, with the Baltimore Police Department? Were there issues?
Yes, I think there were issues. I think there was there were always, you know, I think like any minority community, the concerns about are they there to protect you or are they there to harass you? And so that kind of dilemma is: do you call? What will you get? What will be their position if you call them because you've been mugged or beaten or bashed? And will they be the bashers? So I think that kind of I think that existed all through the 70s. I think to this day, training of police are now, especially now today, it's more about transgendered issues, I think, but, you know, making sure the police are not letting their personal feelings interfere with their obligation to protect people.
Can you talk about throughout your career how you kind of shifted from the type of legal work that you started doing and how you graduated toward LGBT rights?
Yes. I mean, it is an interesting parallel universe. I mean, I went from representing poor people at Legal Aid to then taking on a child abuse and neglect project and became pretty vocal and well-known in Maryland as looking at the protection of children who were abused and neglected by their families, and then was asked to take over the disability program. So I've been representing all of these groups that I really wasn't a part of. I didn't have a disability, I wasn't abused as a child, and I wasn't poor or black. And so I think it became important to me to also get involved in my own community and sort of take some of the skills that I had developed as an advocate, a lawyer, and as a lobbyist to see what I could bring that to bear on something that directly affected me.
So the document that I referred to earlier, which I believe is dated 88, how many years of work do you think that, how long had you been working on that document before it was presented in 88?
Well, quite some time, because we actually had an iteration in 1984 where we had a bill in the city council. Mayor Schaefer was in office at the time, and it went nowhere. And so we got a pretty bad drubbing in 1984. And so there was a four-year history of re-examining what had gone wrong and what we could do differently. And some of it was serendipitous in that Mayor Schmoke was elected, and he, you know, very clearly said that he would support this. We had Mary Pat Clark became the president of the city council, and she was a good advocate. And then, I came back to the community and said, I'm willing to commit. By this time, I had moved over to Washington, and so I was working here and said,
by 1988,
you were... Yeah, 86. I mean, 88 is when the bill passed, but
right.
It was a several-year run-up. Every piece of legislation usually has, you know, that many, many years. I've worked on some pieces of legislation for 3 or 4 years before it's actually come to fruition. So it said that I would be willing to commit to coming back to Baltimore on a fairly regular basis to sort of lead the lobbying effort. But we had other people who were out there, you know, looking for the cases and the stories and trying to put together the document of that, that would, you know, hopefully make the case that this was something that was really necessary and that people were really being impacted by this.
So I kind of wanted to get into the weeds of that particular piece of legislation from 84 to 88. So on a local level, you were working with particular politicians, and I guess I kind of want to ask for your recollections of specific ones. I know some of them were sort of in favor of the legislations, others had to be dragged, and I mean, if we take like Mimi DiPietro as an example, like was just against it, like, and you know, not afraid to say how against it he was.
Indeed, and Mimi was an interesting character. I remember him standing on the floor saying, we are going to, if we pass this bill, we're going to turn this city into San Francisco. And of course, there were a lot of people saying, how bad would that be? And I remember he actually said, and those San Francisco gays, they're bad gays. Our gays are good gays. And we do not want to, you know, turn the city into San Francisco. It's like, oh, this gorgeous, beautiful city that's really wealthy. And you know, so, but we were never going to get Mimi. I mean, Mimi was always going to be, you know, that that representative of that whole, you know, older, you know, white, you know, group. So that was probably someone that we have never really focused on. But we had, you know, we had some very interesting discussions with different people. Iris Reeves was there at the time. And there's a progressive African-American woman who was terrific on civil rights, and we couldn't get her for the longest time. And finally, there was this amazing moment when she said, well, it's not civil rights. And I think it hit me that she saw civil rights as a black person of color issue, and somehow we were appropriating that issue. And I think either I or someone said, well, okay, Iris, what about human rights? And she said, fine, call it human rights, I'll vote for it. And we did, and she did. So it was that kind of trying to figure out where the opposition was. I mean, you had people, I always used to say, we were brilliant in uniting three very disparate factions, Orthodox Jewish community, the black Muslims, and evangelicals. Three groups that probably don't speak to each other, but on this issue, they all came together. And there was the hearing on the bill. We put together a hearing with some very tight, you know, 10, 12, 15 witnesses that, you know, would sort of talk about specific points and specific issues. And we had one father who was terrific. He had twin sons who were fraternal, and one was gay and was not. And he testified about how, why would he treat one of his sons different than the other, and why should one son not have the protections, you know, that his other son had. And I thought that was pretty effective. But the other side had about 150 witnesses. They were lined out the door because, and it was one religious group after another coming in saying this was just the most horrible thing in the world and it was going to ruin the city and life in general. So I thought we were much better organized than that. And in fact, you know, what we said to people was like, you don't think there's discrimination against this population? Listen to these 150 people who just stood up and talked about how horrible they were and how much they would like to do X, Y, and Z to them. They just made our case for us. And I mean, people like Kwasim Mfumi was very nervous. He had the black Muslims picketed on his lawn. I mean, that was an incredible amount of pressure. I was somewhat surprised. When I reached out to the Jewish community, which I had fairly good contacts with, and you know, generally speaking, the Jewish community is pretty progressive and liberal, and in other cities, they were very strong on helping pass gay rights bills. And what I discovered was that Baltimore happened to be the second biggest entry point for immigrants from Russia, which are incredibly Orthodox Jews. And so the Baltimore Jewish community has a very, very huge Orthodox population. And the larger Jewish community said to me, we support you, but we don't want to split our community. And we need to stay together as a united community to protect Israel. And so we can't go out on a limb. And I was like, totally shocked. And so what we had to do is just go around to the more liberal synagogues and get individual letters from individual rabbis to support the bill. But I couldn't get the Baltimore Jewish Council or some of the umbrella organizations that would normally be out front on any other kind of progressive issue because of this very huge influence of the Orthodox community in Baltimore. One of the really interesting stories, I thought, the process is just three readings, and if you get through the first two readings, the third reading is basically pro forma because they've already committed and made their, taken their chances. If they're going to get clobbered for voting for this, they've already sort of staked out their premise. I went in on Monday morning to Mary Pat Clark's office to check in, and I was going to come back to D.C. and then come back late that evening for the vote, the final vote, and then we were going to have a big party at the Hippo to celebrate because it was a done deal. And I came in the morning, and she said, don't leave. The Archbishop has weighed in big time and is trying to marshal last-minute opposition. The two fellows, Bill Cunningham and Jody Landers, who are over in Northeast Baltimore, have been jumped on by the evangelical. They're waffling. We need to spend the day really fighting these forces. So that day that was going to be just a simple little pro forma vote turned into a quite very anxious and very busy time to try to hold these folks together so that they would not... not waver, because the pressure was intense.
You've mentioned Mary Pat, who's still on the scene. Yes. Baltimore, still involved. And I was kind of somewhat shocked reading through this, how many names are still, Carl Stokes only recently got out.
Right. And Ricky Spector is what, I guess.
Is still on the scene. Do you recall anything in particular about dealing with them?
Oh, yes. Well, Ricky Spector, again, has under incredible pressure from the Jewish community. That's her district up there in northwest Baltimore. And she was very, very reluctant, scared, nervous about going out there. And so there was a lot of effort, a lot of people from the Jewish community, LGBT people who were Jewish going to her and trying to get her over the line and resist this, really serious pressure that she got. The sort of the funny story is that the city council meets at 6 o'clock, which in May was pretty still, very bright. It was still, sunset wasn't until like 8. And the Orthodox community came to Ricky and said, this is Shavuos, a very obscure, I think, Jewish holiday, and this is an abomination that you are going to vote for this gay rights bill on this important Jewish holiday. And so here Ricky comes into Mary Pat's office and says, we cannot vote tonight on this bill. And so what we did is they convened at 6 o'clock, adjourned, and came back at 9 o'clock at sunset and voted on the bill. So we didn't vote on the bill on Shavuos. So, what is this, 30 years later, every time I hear the word Shavuos, I kind of like break out in a sweat, because that was, another last-ditch effort to try to derail this bill. And so it was those kinds of, that's the sort of the interesting sort of stories that probably don't show up in any kind of writings about all of the twists and turns that something like this takes.
And that was on the third reader, right?
On the third reader, this was, so again, we said, what do we do? And I said, well, come back to my house. Everybody just come back up to Reed Street, bring the food that we were all going to have at the Hippo and hang out, go back at 9 o'clock, have the vote, and then go to the Hippo at 10 o'clock and have this big party. And that's what we did.
Do you recall how the vote went?
Ooh, off the top of my head. Well, we didn't get Tim Murphy, who never voted. We didn't get Mimi. I think we had the three.
Can I stop you?
Yes.
This just gave me a message that it has stopped automatically. Why would it do that?
It got bored with me if you didn't. Good, I need some water.
Yeah, I'll redo that.
Yeah, and I don't think I remember exactly. I'd have to look at that.
Okay, then we can abandon.
I can remember certain ones we didn't get. We never were going to get.
It's possible that it reached a full for the... Is that... We've been going for about a half an hour?
It's
1:15. Is this okay?
Yeah, this is great. I think we're good. Good to go. All right, so I won't ask you about how the vote went because that's kind of my new ship. But there was a celebration after.
Yes. One thing I wonder, just to give you some background and how I got sort of involved in this, because I think it's an important part of the story. As you know, in the late 70s, 79, 80, we began to hear about this disease that was affecting gay men. And at first it was almost, a flip kind of thing, gays have their own cancer. And then it grew and grew and became relatively devastating. And it started to happen in Baltimore as well. Now we were a little bit out of the mainstream of New York and San Francisco, but it started to affect a lot of the people that I knew. And I was approached by a doctor, Frank Polk, who came to me in 1982 and said, I know that you're very well known in the gay community, and I have a research grant at Hopkins, and I need to find 1,200 gay men to be a part of the study. And I basically just laughed and said, well, there's no way you're going to get 1,200 gay men to come to Johns Hopkins and admit they're gay and participate in this study. Because we had just had an experience about a year before when the Gay Community Center decided to have our very first fundraiser. And we were able to secure the brand new, recently opened aquarium. And we were very excited about having this first ever fundraiser. And sold tickets, and a lot of us went out and got all of our friends to come. And people converged on the aquarium for this great event. And the press was there with Klieg lights and cameras. And about a third of the people who bought the tickets left and didn't go because they didn't want to take the chance of being seen or be filmed or be on the press, which another example of the kind of discrimination that the community felt, that they couldn't even be comfortable going to this fundraiser. So based on that, I thought that Dr. Polk was, a fool's errand, frankly. But I joined with him, and we began a two-year journey to get people to come to the Hopkins. Many stories there, but we finally did it. I remember going to the Hippo on a Saturday night with Dr. Polk and asking them to turn off the music at 11 o'clock and saying, this horrible thing is destroying our community. You've got to join this study. And people would scream, turn the music on. You're bringing us down. We want to dance. And, and so it was really tough, but we got them there. But the point of the story is that dealing there, and I demanded there be an advisory board for this study because I didn't trust Hopkins myself. It had sort of a reputation. By having worked with legal aid, the black community thought that Hopkins was this experimental, often not very open place. And having that experience, I said, I want to make sure we have some control over Hopkins as we come in and give them all of this incredible personal identifying information. But as a result of that, I was appointed to Governor Hughes's AIDS task force, and then later on by Governor Schaefer, who then fired me and then reappointed me. But through that experience is when I saw a lot more of the discrimination, sort of the HIV-gay relationship. And that's when I decided that we needed to have a civil rights bill in the city, and that's when I got involved in 1984. But it came out of my experience of having dealt with the HIV crisis.
So I want to ask you about that study. I did read a little bit about that. So it started, do you recall the year it started?
Oh, I certainly do. As I said, I started working with Frank in 1982. We did the first visit in 1984, and I just went to my 60th visit back in December. So this study, which was a four-year study, has been so incredibly successful that the NIH has continued to fund it every 4 years. And so it's been going on for over 30 years. Many interesting stories. At the end of the fourth year, when we thought we were ending, we were going to have, another party to celebrate the fact that Hopkins was actually quite amazed. The attendance, the compliance was higher than any other research study that they had ever conducted. So they were quite blown away by that. And we decided to have this party. I was chairman of the advisory board. We were in a Turner Auditorium in Hopkins, and we were giving out prizes, and I'm on the microphone talking about how this is a great tribute to the gay community and how dedicated and devoted we are to try to take responsibility and deal with this issue. And what I don't know is that that's being piped downstairs into the area where we're going to go downstairs and have refreshments. And all of the caterers and staff who were down there hearing all of this talk about gay, AIDS, HIV. And when we came downstairs for the refreshments, these people had gone out, literally run out into the community and bought every imaginable pair of gloves that they could find. And when we came down to have chicken wings and carrot sticks, the staff was all standing there with every kind of imaginable glove you could have, which initially was funny until, kind of hit us about what was going on. And I ended up going to the president of Hopkins, Steve Mueller at the time, and said, this is not going to happen. You get all this federal money. We will kill this study if you don't fire people, if you don't do something about protecting this community in any of the things you're doing. Because those were the days when orderlies would come in to, if someone was in the hospital and had AIDS, they would literally push the cart with the food into the room and not go in to the room. So that's what sort of got me into this whole issue about the incredible discrimination. And of course, people assumed if you were gay, you had AIDS. And there was people made that connection all the time. So there was a strong connection between the AIDS epidemic and the need for LGBT protections.
I want to ask you more about the public's general misunderstanding and all the disinformation, but it's interesting. So you had this first event at the aquarium, and a third of the crowd leaves. But at the end of 4 years, you're having an event at Hopkins, and things had changed to the extent that at least people felt comfortable staying. Was it that the press did? Was it more insular because it was protected by Hopkins and done more on campus than a public space?
Possibly, but I guess I would say we were terrified. Our friends were dying. And so I think that was a catalyst for getting people together.
So I believe I was in high school at this time, and I remember the crazy things people, the misunderstanding of how the disease worked, how it could. Do you feel that, how long do you, from the time that the community notices people are starting to die, how long did it take for people to really gain any understanding? I mean, so you have a catering staff that runs out to buy gloves and is in hysterics over what they've heard. How long did it take before, people started being reasonable and trying to understand? On Johns Hopkins campus, an institution of higher learning where you'd think awareness might be higher than in other places.
I would argue that to this very day that we haven't gotten there fully. I mean, when I was working on the Americans with Disabilities Act here in Washington in 1989-90, there was a big push to not cover HIV food workers. And the line they were using was that they're blood in the salad. If the Americans with Disabilities Act protects HIV-infected food workers, they'll cut themselves, bleed in the salad, and everybody else will get AIDS.
Right.
So that was 1989-90. And now we're, to this day, I don't think we have full understanding. HIV is still a very stigmatized, even though it's now become a chronic disease, and the chances of, people don't die from it, et cetera, et cetera. There's still, I think, a fairly, even within the gay community, there's still, the stigma of being positive versus being negative.
I want to go back to the study just to sort of place it in the context mm-hmm. of the field of research. You say it's still going on. I imagine it wasn't the first major research institution working on AIDS, but it was an important study.
It was. Well, it was called the multi cohort study. The NIH had funded five centers: New York, L.A., Pittsburgh, Baltimore, and Chicago. And the Pittsburgh, Baltimore, where they said they were trying to look at high incidence cities and low incidence cities to try to see. Again, remember, we're in the early 80s. They have not discovered HIV. We have no idea what is causing this thing. There is much less any kind of treatment. And so one of the first things, and I think the study, the five studies contributed to, we were going through the study. We had actually had three visits when Gallo and Montagne had discovered that it was HIV and that it was bloodborne. So two things happened. One, they didn't need all the other bodily fluids that we were providing. This was a very stunning moment, and for me was that Frank Polk came to our advisory board, which I was chairing, and said, "So I have a question to ask you. We have gone back and tested the blood of everybody in this study from the first study, the second visit, and the third visit. I know the HIV status of everybody in this study. What do I do with that information?" Now, in retrospect, I think maybe it would have been, of course you tell them, but in 1985, when there was no AZT, there was nothing, we were probably one of the first groups in the country that had to think about what do you do with that information when there's nothing that you can do with it. Now, I would argue in retrospect, the fact that they could have infected more people, we did take the position that people could ask and we would tell them, but we didn't mandatorily, tell them. One other thing I would say in thinking about this is, because I would surmise that these 1,200 men who were coming to this study from 84 on, I think that was an empowering experience for them. And so that's what made, I think, more people much more comfortable to come out and then lobby and be open around the Civil Rights Bill. So I think there's a connection there that we went from the 1980 when people were afraid to go to an aquarium dance to 1985 and 86 where people were willing to come out and demonstrate and lobby for a Civil Rights Bill. And certain people did that on their own, but I think the group of men who participated in the study were, maybe not even realizing it, and certainly made me much more of an activist and made me get out there, and I think a lot of other people became more comfortable with being gay by participating in the study. So I don't think that wasn't the point of the study. It was definitely a research study for medical reasons, but I think, and I don't know if we've ever even written about the sort of the empowering of those people by coming forward, and it was an incredibly invasive story. Every aspect of your life is drug use, sex. Now it's morphed into almost an aging study about how do you, can you care for yourself as you get older? It's been a remarkable experience.
That would be an interesting topic to research.
Yeah, it would, actually. I'm just thinking about that. I wish someone would have back and said, how did that impact on the civil rights movement growing out of that horror.
Do you recall how far the study's reach was? Was it mostly men from Baltimore, or did it all of Maryland? How far?
Well, it actually, that's an interesting question. We had gotten to about 800 of the 1,200, and Frank was this most amazing man who I love dearly. He got nervous, and so he opened it up to Washington. And so a good third of the study participants are from D.C. But again, the compliance, you know, these people schlepping up from D.C. twice a year with their little bags full of stuff and subjecting themselves to this incredibly invasive, it takes a couple of several hours of your time. So that's how we got the full 1,200, because I guess I was right. Getting 1,200 men out of Baltimore was going to be tough.
Thank you for sharing all of that. That's an amazing story. Can you talk about how you think LGBTQ activism has changed from the 80s to today? It's a very general question, but...
Well, it's incredibly well-organized and well-funded. I, in the 90s, came on the board of HRCF at the time, the Human Rights Campaign, and it was a very small, fledgling organization. And now it's this huge, you know, group with their own building over on 17th Street, and there's, you know, Lambda Legal Defense and GLSEN and all kinds of, we do a lot of work with the various transgendered associations. So, you know, clearly it's grown, it's organized, it's NGLTF, you know, there's just a whole plethora of LGBT organizations that are working on every level, state, local, and federal. And I was very involved in the hate crimes legislation, the Byrd-Shepherd Act. I was there to make sure disability stayed in the Hate Crimes Act, but obviously worked very closely with all of the gay organizations and also the race organizations to make sure that bill passed, which it did, finally. So it's gone from, you know, sort of a volunteer kind of base to, a very well-organized, well-funded effort, and thank goodness.
Have you been active in the struggle for transgendered rights? And in addition to that, I know we're not supposed to get too contemporary in this, but I think it'll be interesting for people in the future reading about how you feel about now. Do you feel like with our current administration that transgendered rights are in jeopardy?
So I can make this historical because this is one of my favorite stories. In 1973, I was at Legal Aid, and a person came into my office and said that they were a transgendered person, and they were on Medicaid, and they had all of their drugs and hormones and therapy had been paid by Medicaid because it kind of like wasn't really, it was kind of hidden in that Medicaid didn't know that those particular hormones were for that particular issue. But now she wanted to have the surgery, and Medicaid denied it. Because it was elective surgery. And I took the case. And I did a Medicaid appeal in 1973 to say that I thought Medicaid should be able to cover, transgendered sexual conversion, transgendered surgery. Probably took them about 5 seconds to deny it, and I lost. But another important lesson for me was several weeks later, my boss came to me and asked me what was going on in the waiting room. And I went out, and this person had gone back to her community, which I didn't really know existed in 1973. And I believe said, there's a guy at Legal Aid who treated me with respect, listened to me, and fought for me. And all these other people came to me, you know, to talk about their particular issues. And what it taught me then, and I think I carry to this day, is that you don't often have to win your case. You really, especially with, you know, vulnerable people who are stigmatized, if you treat them with respect and listen to them and try to help them, that's almost as important as winning. So I am 20 years later, 30 years later, I came on the board of the Free State Justice, which was the transgender legal clinic. And people asked, we were around the board meeting and asked why people were there. And I said, I'm here for revenge. I want to win that case from 1973 that I lost. And I think there was just fairly recently a case saying that Medicaid had to pay for that surgery. And I think some prisons actually pay for it. And the military will pay for it, or at least they were. So I got involved with transgender issues, you know, inadvertently from the early 70s. And as a result of, you know, stayed, and then I was on the board of most recently with Free State Justice that provides legal services to the transgender community. So I think that is sort of seems to be the cutting edge, the new frontier, and certainly with all of the attempts at bathroom bills and like that, that's sort of become the rallying cry for people who are against these kinds of things. But I also think that's just exactly that. I think it's a way of trying to backtrack on LGBT rights totally by singling out that particular population.
So there are still certain southern states that are fighting things like which bathrooms people can use.
Wedding cakes.
I wonder to what extent should we be worried about our current administration, which seems to have a retrogressive view of how it should work in the military. Is this something people are worried about?
Absolutely. And they should be. Just about everything, but clearly in this arena, there are some serious problems. We made great progress in the Obama administration through executive order, through policies. I was just recently called by the disability divisions that I work with saying, and I remember talking to them saying, well, are you getting any direction, from the White House about disability? And they said, no. Nothing happening. Oh, they did tell us to take any reference to sexual orientation or transgender out of any of our materials. They would do a survey on disability, and one of the questions was, are you gay or lesbian or transgendered? And to me, there are various issues about disability and LGBT rights. And I did several LGBT disability forums at the White House under the Obama administration, and now this administration is scrubbing everything that they touch to make sure that this is sort of put away. So I think there's great concern. And then, of course, the whole military transgender thing and, just one thing after another. Certainly the vice president has an incredibly horrible record on these issues. And, for people who think it'll be great to see President Trump go, you may be careful what you wish for. So we're all very concerned about, which is why some of these civil rights protections are so critical to this day, because we're easily can fall back, I think, into some other bad situations.
If we're okay on time, I want to dip back, and you mentioned a name that I had meant to ask you about.
Sure.
Sounded like a much more interesting story. I wanted to ask you about working with then-Mayor Schaefer, who, of course, went on to be governor, and the particular Baltimore City Council legislation that we had been speaking about. What was it like working with Mayor Schaefer? And you mentioned that at some point he fired you and reappointed you, and that sounds like a fascinating story.
Well, frankly, we didn't really work with Mayor Schaefer on the bill. He was just totally against it, as a single man, I mean, the stories were legion for years about the fact that he, in fact, was a closeted gay man. And I personally, for me, it was like, I don't care. I need him. I don't need him to be gay. I don't need him to be out. I need him to support this bill. And he wouldn't. So it pretty much, and it was critical, because what happens in any of this legislative arena, if a member of Congress, or a city councilman, a legislator, if they think they're going to take a very hard vote on something that's really going to potentially damage their survival, and it's not going to pass, why do it? It's a no-brainer in their DNA that if it passes, then at least I've gone out on a plank and something's happened. But if it's not going to pass, why am I, you know, jeopardizing my career. And having the mayor, then Mayor Schaefer, against it, we knew he wouldn't sign it if it passed. So that meant all those people on the fence, I'm not touching it. Now, it totally turned around when we had Mayor Schmoeck, because when Mayor Schmoeck said, I'll sign a bill if you bring it to me, that gave us and them the ability to say, this can happen. So now your vote really is critical. And that's, at least for the middle ground people, you know, that's having that leadership is incredible. So Mayor Schaefer was a serious, serious detriment to us in 1984. And then he becomes the governor. And I've always said, you know, somewhat facetiously but true, that this is a man who hated, didn't care about social services, really didn't care about education, didn't really care about health. He cared about building stuff and, you know, the Inner Harbor. And so what does he do? He gets to be the governor who does education, health, and, you know, social services. All the things he's least comfortable with, he's now in charge of. So it was kind of like a Peter Principle to the max. And then, of course, he's dealing with this HIV crisis, and so he creates a governor's task force. And I'm on it. Frank Polk is on it. A variety of other people, and we were fighting. And at that time, there was all this: we've got to test everybody, and, you know, mandatory testing. And my position was, no mandatory testing unless there's civil rights protection, because if you're going to find out everybody's HIV status through some government, you know, mandatory law, that means they then now are going to be subject to discrimination, and you have to have protections for that. So for me, they were always linked, and. We got pretty testy and pretty, outspoken, and so he fired us. And then I guess there was a fairly big outcry, and then he reconstituted. I'd been on Governor Hughes's task force, and then I carried over to Governor Schaefer's, and then got bumped, but then got back on. So it was quite a contentious relationship with him. And he would see me, and we would go back and forth. But he was not, unfortunately, a friend of the gay community. And I mean, there certainly were stories. I mean, I think in his later life, people told me that they had spent time with him, and, you know, in social settings where, I guess, it turned out that he might have been. So, again, I don't know that for me, as a mayor and a governor, I wanted him to be a leader on these issues, and it didn't really make a difference what his sexual orientation was.
And then toward the end, he started sounding more like a Tea Party type.
He was a very complicated man, I guess. Beloved by lots of people. I had very good friends who just thought he was, and to this day people talk about, oh, we need a Mayor Schaefer, you know, in Baltimore to clean up the alleys. I mean, one of his favorite things was to go up and down the alleys and call the housing department or the public works and say, get over here and clean up this alley. And getting off the track, but remember what I told you, I was living in one of those houses that was bought to be torn down for the highway. When I came to Baltimore, he was a proponent of putting the highway through the Inner Harbor. And people like Barbara Mikulski and others fought him and stopped the road. Then they built the Inner Harbor, and he gets all that credit for, you know, the huge renovation of the harbor. People forget that he was very much about, you know, in the late 60s, wanting that road to go through where now all of that incredible, you know, development is. So
he could have been Wilmington, Delaware.
Or anyway, Albany, New York. Governor Rockefeller built a highway right along the Hudson River. I mean, it's ridiculous. And what could now have been, a waterfront kind of thing has got this gigantic concrete highway. So anyway, Schaefer was quite a complex man with varying kinds of things. But I'd probably get beat up badly if I say there's people who really thought he was just terrific.
Right. So I'm sort of wrapping it up. I wanted to, you before we get off on the Mayor-Governor Schaefer tangent, you started talking about how your career sort of gravitated toward working with the National Disability Rights Network. And you identified a connection between your civil rights activism, gay activism, and this. Can you talk about your work here? What the role of this organization is, and how you see yourself?
Well, again, I think my career has been one of these kind of serendipitous things, not always, you know, starting out with goals and accomplishing them. I was winding down my child abuse project in Maryland, where we were, you know, I thought did some really good work about passing legislation on forcing mandatory reporting of child abuse and neglect, and creating various service programs to help abused parents of abused kids who are abusing their kids. And I got a call saying there's a new entity that's just being created by Congress called the Protection and Advocacy Agency, and it's there's one in Maryland now, and we need someone to take it over and run it. And I said, well, I don't have any real experience with the disability community. I don't have a disability. I didn't really have any close family friends, and that's often the way people get into the disability advocacy world, is through their own experience or, you know, family contacts. And they said, we don't care. You have a reputation being able to build up programs, you know, at Legal Aid, the child abuse program. So I said, well, okay. And again, just luckily, it coincided with the passage of some very strong disability civil rights legislation. I found the issues very interesting, very challenging legally. Began to, you know, going out to Rosewood State Hospital. It's been interesting to.
I'm sorry.
Sure.
It stopped again. I think there was also a blinking battery light.
Are you?
Sorry. I guess it must be nearing the hour mark.
Are you okay, David? I mean, I don't want to. You are. You all right?
That's really my last question. So we,
okay.
We can
wrap up that. Well, yeah. That's quite all right.
Okay, sorry about that. So we were talking about how you came to be here at the
right.
National Disability Rights Network.
Well, as I said earlier, I was asked to take over this new entity, and it coincided with coming on board of some really good legal protections for people with disabilities, and that sort of, you know, fit nicely into what I've been doing, you know, representing initially poor people and then abused children, and then seeing the disability community as also another vulnerable, stigmatized group, and so it just seemed to, you know, fit nicely. And then, again, kind of a consistent guy in my approach to stuff. And when I was running the child abuse program, we had formed an association of these federally funded child abuse programs, and when I came to Maryland, I came to the Disability Rights now it's called Disability Rights Maryland. At the time, it was called something else. I asked around to some of my colleagues, saying, do we have a national association in Washington that's representing us, since we're totally dependent on federal money? And the answer was not yet. So I helped, along with the others, created the NDRN. And then, because I was near Washington, started coming over almost as a volunteer. And then I were able to start raising money, and I became a consultant. And then eventually they said, well, you either had to be full-time or, you know, we'll get somebody else. And by that time I had really gotten into this issue around in Washington, and had some success in getting another additional program through Congress added to the network, and it's been. And, you know, to me, it all is of a piece, that it's all about, you know, trying to protect people from discrimination, trying to make sure that people can live their lives fully and be integrated. Integration in the community is a big issue in the disability world because of the historical reliance on congregate institutions like Rosewood in Maryland that were horrible. But, you know, I think there's an analogy to the gay community who aren't able to, and for many people, not feeling able to be out and be who they are and be public who they are. So I think there's a fair amount of connection with, or abused children, or the stigma of welfare recipients, which is now coming back again. So to me, it's been kind of a consistent career, and I've been fortunate to be able to meld those things together and sort of have a foot in each camp. And it's very fun, as I said earlier, with the hate crimes bill, where I'm working side by side with the other LGBT groups. I happen to be bringing the disability perspective in there, but it was, to work with that crowd was great. And then, obviously, during the lobbying for the ADA, fighting it was clearly a strategy by some people to use the HIV/AIDS crisis as a wedge to try to stop the passage of the ADA, and being able to talk about that issue from a very personal experience, history, sort of all came together. So I consider myself a very lucky person, professionally and personally, that these parts of my life have sort of come together in kind of a nice synergy.
How long have you been here with NDR?
Well, I started, as I said, consulting with them in 1982, and then became the executive director in 1986. So this is 32 years. It's a pretty robust organization. It's nice to have a lot of staff that can do a lot of the things that I used to do myself alone. The agencies have grown considerably. We're on the cusp of a new program, hopefully tonight, that will infuse some more money into my clients so they can expand the representation of individuals with disabilities. So it changes. And the changing administrations, while it can be nerve-wracking and disconcerting, it's also forces you to rethink strategies and figure how you're going to position these issues to a different set of people who may not have the same sense of ideas or commitment that the last group did. So that's a challenge that kind of makes it still fresh and interesting.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that I should have asked you about?
No, I'm pretty sure you covered a lot of the stuff that I've been able to be a part of, and I feel lucky to have done that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this, and thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I'm very thrilled that the Maryland Historical Society is, trying to build up an archive on LGBT issues, and I think it's a great effort. And
I'm thrilled as well. Yeah, right. It's great.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sorry there, I got a little bump.